Stay tuned for a Juno Afternoon. We'll talk with folks from the Perseverance Theater to learn about the star performances which are coming up. We'll learn about a new Thai restaurant in town, as well as about the Sentinel Lighthouse. We'll talk with Jessica Edwards about this year's Southeast Alaska State Fair in Haines, that Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, and more. That's next on a Juno Afternoon.
For National Native News, I'm Stephen Emmons in for Antonio Gonzalez. One Native American delegate to the Republican National Convention says the race and culture of the event's participants shouldn't matter. Sherry Powell from the Crow Nation tells Gannett News that Americans are looking for leaders and she doesn't care what color they are or what culture they're from. She admits the GOP needs to work on looking, quote, more like America. The four-day convention gets underway on Monday in Cleveland. Speaker of the House Paul Ryan, who was tapped to open the convention, came under fire over the weekend for posting a selfie on Instagram with a room full of Republican interns. The overwhelming majority of the young people crowded into the picture are white. The convention ends on Thursday, presumably after nominating Donald Trump to be the party's candidate for president. Commercial hiking companies in northern Arizona are facing an uncertain future after the Havasupai tribe canceled guided trips to the iconic Havasupai Falls. The closure follows federal animal abuse charges recently brought against a member of the tribe who packed gear for the companies. Arizona Public Radio's Ryan Heinches reports.
Hundreds of guiding reservations were canceled last week after the Havasupai Council temporarily halted the trips. Tribal officials say they're devising a new plan to manage pack animals contracted by guiding companies that haul gear nearly 10 miles to Supai Village. A member of the tribe was charged with felony animal abuse in April. Several of his horses were found severely malnourished and in need of medical attention. According to tribal officials, the new regulations will also address group size and permit fees. They say all hiking reservations will eventually be made through the Havasupai's tourism office. Several companies lead trips to the Havasupai campground on a regular basis, often guiding more than 20 clients at a time. Access to the area is still available for non-guided visitors with reservations. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heinches in Flagstaff.
The emergency room is back open at the Indian Health Service Hospital in Rosebud, South Dakota. The service was shuttered 7 months ago after a federal report highlighted several shortcomings, including a broken sanitizer that forced staff to hand wash surgical instruments. During the closure, ambulances drove patients to emergency rooms as far as 55 miles away. The Sioux Falls Argus Leader reports at least 7 people died in transit to the farther emergency rooms. In a written release, IHS Principal Deputy Director Mary Smith called resuming 24 hours a day, 7 days a week operation a milestone. The Great Plains region of the IHS came under fire for shoddy and dangerous methods at several facilities. The issues came to light during hearings by the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs starting last year. Since closing, the Rosebud facility has since been renovated and passed inspection by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services last week. A week after flooding caused by torrential rains, a Lake Superior tribe is assessing damage on its Wisconsin reservation. The flooding cut off the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa from regular routes to food, water, and medical supplies. Danielle Kading reports.
Bad River's Flood Command spokesman Dylan Jennings says the tribe is doing what it can for members.
The ones that have lost their houses and whatnot are being put up in either the casino lodge or in some of the other local hotels in the area and taken care of in that way.
The tribe is advising members to drink bottled water or boil their water to avoid contamination from floodwaters. Jennings says historical markers for old burial sites and the tribe's powwow grounds are among the areas still underwater. He says the tribe hasn't been able to check on Monoman or wild rice beds since the flooding. For National Native News, I'm Daniel Kading in Superior, Wisconsin.
And I'm Stephen Emmons.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support provided by the award-winning game Never Alone, a video game based on Inupiat tales and made in partnership with the Alaska Native community. In Never Alone, a young Inupiat girl and her Arctic fox brave harsh and beautiful Arctic environments, meet fascinating characters, and search for the source of an eternal blizzard that threatens the survival of everything they know. Never Alone is available now on the App Store and Google Play. More information at neveralonegame.com. Support by the National Museum of the American Indian, presenting the 2016 Native Cinema Showcase August 16th to the 21st in Santa Fe, New Mexico, the week of Indian Market. Information at americanindian.si.edu.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
And welcome to a Juno Afternoon. My name is Lori Scandlin. I'm in the studio with our producer, Jeff Brown, taking a quick look at the weather. It is, of course, a prize winner day at the moment. It's going to break down a little bit beginning tomorrow night, although precipitation is only at about, 40%, and that is after 10 p.m. tomorrow night. Throughout the rest of the week, there will be a 30 to 40% chance of rain until the weekend when the forecast says rain likely. So chances are we've got a nice week ahead of us. Do enjoy the sunshine. In the studio with us are a bunch of folks from the Perseverance Star Program, which is a summer theater production, which has, as I recall, when we talked about this in the spring, I think this might be about the 25th year, we're pleased to have Dawn Colden. She is one of the directors of one of the three productions that the young folks have been working on the last few weeks. Dawn is directing Singing in the Rain, and Missouri Smythe, who's the music director, is also here. And I'd like to welcome three performers who are joining us as well today. All of them are veterans. Electra, who is 13 and in her third year in the program. Jillian, who is 17 and in her third year in the program. And Tommy, who's 11, and he is a second-year veteran. Thanks for coming by today. So, Dawn, give us the nuts and bolts. The STAR program, which happens every summer and targets youth who are interested in some kind of theater, is happening now, and I would assume that the closure is about to happen, which means public performances. So tell us what's going on and what the folks who might be interested in attending can expect.
Okay. Well, what's going on is we got together about 3 weeks ago, and students in ranges from 10 to 18 years old chose a play that they wanted to work on. So we have Antigone, directed by Donnie Gotz, Extreme Theater by K. Brian Neal, who came up from Seattle and is hired as a physical actor, and they're working on writing a show and performing it, and then the musical, which is myself in Missouri, and Singing in the Rain. So students choose, and then we rehearse every day for 3 hours with our small group, and then we meet together in a big group and work on acting skills and techniques, and then we actually open this Friday.
Quite exciting. So are the three performers here with you all in the musical?
They are in the musical because the other performers are rehearsing at the theater right now for the other two shows, and we rehearse in the morning.
Let's start with Jillian. Jillian, you're the oldest of the crew here and probably the most veteran person in terms of being in performances since middle school, although you've been in STAR 3 years. This is your fifth year as a performer. Tell me what draws you to this kind of work and this kind of activity. It is summertime.
Well, what draws me to this program is I started out doing ballet when I was really, really little, so I started my life out on the stage, and once I stopped doing ballet, I searched out for what else I could spin on the stage, and I actually met Dawn my eighth grade year doing Oliver, and that's how I got into it, and I realized how fantastic it was, so I've done all the plays all middle school year and high school year, and then we found Perseverance and the STAR program, and I did it because of the family, and there's so many skills you can learn from it. I mean, just helping speaking-wise in public has really helped me a lot. I mean, Dawn here works very hard to make sure that the actors don't say on stage, and I can tell you that that has really benefited my life.
Well, you haven't said yet, so you are a testament to Dawn's skills. Tommy, you're coming back for your second year. Tell me why you came back after your first year. What kind of experience did you have?
Well, I came back because last year I did it and it was so fun, and I had so much fun doing it because of like the energy. Everybody there works hard and has a great time, so it really makes your summer better.
Are you nervous about going on stage, Tommy, or did you feel like you worked that out last year?
Last year I was kind of nervous to go on stage, but I kind of directed it, all the energy into staying focused, and so I think I won't be as nervous this year because I've done it before.
Great. Electra, you are a three-year veteran. What are you finding out about Singing in the Rain that might be more challenging than the other two productions you were in the last 2 years? And I guess I should ask, did you choose to be in musicals the last 2 years as well?
The last 2 years I did choose to be in musicals because I've always found musicals like so different than other plays, and they just bring a lot of joy to you, and I think they're a lot more playful than most other plays. And I think Singing in the Rain is, I think it's great because it kind of it introduces you to like the transition they had between the silent movies and the talkies. And so I think that's a really great thing, and they kind of mix that with music.
Is there anything about this particular musical that you have found more challenging than the past two, or are you finding it a little bit easier now that you're on your, you know, your third play?
I actually find it a bit easier, not by much, because I've had a lot of experience with Donna, Missouri, and then now I know kind of like what they want and expect of me. And so I feel like this year it is a bit more easier. Yes.
Great. Missouri, you have been a musical director with youth on a number of levels for more than two decades. Tell me a little bit about the challenge of working with talent that's raw, talent that is in development, and particularly teens.
So one of the challenges that I have with teens is we've got a large age range from 10 to 18, that's the age. And so bringing those voices together, we have boys included in the cast, and so sometimes the voices are changing. The musicals that are written typically try and accommodate that, but when you've got young boys who are at different ends of the spectrum, sometimes that can be a challenge. And if the young man's voice has not changed, then I challenge them to sing the upper parts, and if their voices are changing, then they can usually adjust and sing the lower parts with the girls. And then one of the other challenges is to teach young people how to breathe correctly, and singing in 3 weeks is a challenge. So most of the time we do a lot of that breathing, because once they're on stage and they're singing and they're doing movement, that breath is so important for them to be successful at acting, moving, and it's a musical, singing as well. So,
how many different songs will the actors need to know?
We have, and correct me kids if I'm incorrect, we have a total of 33 pieces of music in Singing in the Rain. Some of them are short excerpts between scenes. So I would say the kids are probably singing 20 pieces of music, depending on which part of the musical they're at. Yeah,
that's a tall order.
Yes.
Don, what is your role as director? Do you have to make sure every single piece is right? Are you able to turn part of it over to other folks who are helping to teach this program? Talk about your involvement, which now has covered quite a few years.
Yeah. My involvement, I also like to and get to choreograph the pieces, and we have an assistant named Jessie Jones who is also, I actually directed her, I'd say, 7 years ago, and she was one of the young people that I directed, and then she actually got to come up and be the assistant, and now she's assistant to the whole program. And so, yeah, my role is definitely the direction of the actors and training the actors, and just like they both have talked about, focus is super important to me, and being focused, and but also having a lot of energy, and I like to choreograph. I don't like to come into a show with the choreography done. I like to actually look at their bodies and see how they like to work, and then I go home and work off of them. And in fact, Jillian has been doing a lot of that with me with her dance background. So we have people dance, then we stop, and we put it in so that the movement actually goes with their bodies naturally.
So this is a very immersive program in terms of using all parts of the youth's brains and voices and bodies as well.
Yeah.
What? Tell us. Go ahead, Dawn.
Oh, I just thought, yes, we had a moment today where, I'm not going to say a name, but we had an actor who who is getting older and he's starting to, his brain, you know, brain development. Lori and I worked together before, but brain development, his brain is closing because he's getting older, and so he's losing the vulnerability. And that is why I like working with all ages, because the younger people have their souls open still and their brains open. So we said to him, you've got to get vulnerable again and play on stage, because it's called a play, so all the focus and discipline that goes into it, and then you allow yourself to open and be vulnerable.
How many actors are in the play that you're producing, Singing in the Rain? And then do you know how many youth are participating in the program as a whole this summer?
Yep, we have 18 in our cast, and Kate, Brian, Neil's cast, Extreme Theater, that they're writing and performing their own piece, they have 4. And Antigone, I think, has 8.
So that's quite a crew, but yours is the biggest.
Yes.
Well, tell us the times where folks can come and see the youth produce. Let's see, Jillian, you're going to share that with us?
Yes. Star runs this Friday, July 22nd through Sunday, July 30th at Perseverance on the main stage. Singing in the Rain is July 22nd at 7:30. And then again, we have another show on Sunday, July 24th at 2 o'clock. And then another Friday, July 29th at 7:30. Antigone has a show on July 23rd at 2 o'clock. That's a Saturday. And then that next Wednesday, July 27th, they have a show at 7:30. And then again on Saturday, July 30th, they have a show at 7:30. And Extreme Theater has a show July 23rd at 7:30 p.m. Then that next Thursday, July 28th at 7:30 p.m. And then that Saturday, July 30th at 7:30 p.m.
And Electra, do you have something to add to that? I see you looking studiously at that announcement. So, Jillian, let me first compliment you on your enunciation.
Thank you.
Quite good. Electra, something else to add?
You can get the tickets at ptalaska.org at the theater and Hart side, or you can get them in the lobby when you are about to enter the show.
And how much does it cost for a ticket? Anybody know? About $10?
I think it's $10 for adults.
Okay,
$10 and $5 for students.
For the big people, and $5 for youth.
And I will say we have turned people away at the door, and we have sold out.
Ooh, so don't assume. Don't assume. Now, there were a lot of dates and times, but I imagine that at pt.org, which is Perseverance Theater, .org, but just PT, because Perseverance and Theater are both kind of hard to spell sometimes, you can find all of the times of this summer's STAR program. There are 3 productions, Singing in the Rain, Antigone, and Extreme Theater. So look for those productions beginning this weekend, and I want to thank the whole cast and crew who are in here right now, and to all of those who are working on the program. Thanks for stopping by.
Thank you.
For the invitation.
Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 18th of July, 2016. It's the birthday of Thackeray, William Makepeace Thackeray, 1811, Calcutta. His father worked for the East India Company. He grew up there, then moved to London, became a journalist, and in 1847, he wrote his novel Vanity Fair, published in monthly installments, about the well-born and passive Amelia Sedley and the ambitious, adventurous Becky Sharp. In the end, everybody appears to get what he or she wants, though Thackeray does close with the lines, which of us is happy in this world? Which of us has his desire, or having it, is satisfied? It was on this day, 1870, the First Vatican Council declared the doctrine of papal infallibility, that the Pope, when he speaks ex cathedra, that is, makes a statement about an issue of faith or morality that's been divinely revealed to him, cannot possibly be erroneous. It's the birthday of Elizabeth Gilbert, 1969, Waterbury, Connecticut, who after college went traveling the country, taking odd jobs, ranches and diners and bars. Listening to people talk, she turned this into a short story collection called Pilgrims, and then a novel, Stern Men, and then came her wildly successful memoir back in 2006, Eat, Pray, Love, the story of her travels through Italy, India, and Indonesia after a divorce. Her latest book, a memoir called Big Magic, Creative Living Beyond Fear. And it's the birthday of the American journalist Hunter S. Thompson, 1937, in Louisville, author of Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, who as a young man spent his free time typing out A Farewell to Arms, trying to learn the prose style of Ernest Hemingway. And he committed suicide in 2005 at the age of 67, leaving a suicide note that said, 67, that is 17 years past 50, 17 more than I needed or wanted. Boring. Here's a poem for today by Leo Dangle, his elderly father as a young man. This happened before I met your mother. I took Jenny Johansson to a summer dance, and she sent me a letter, a love letter, I guess, even if the word love wasn't in it. She wrote that she had a good time and didn't want the night to end. At home, she lay down on her bed, but stayed awake, listening to the songs of morning birds outside her window. I read that letter 100 times and kept it in a cigar box with useless things I had saved, a pocket knife with an imitation pearl handle and a broken blade, a harmonica I never learned to play, one cufflink, an empty rifle shell. When your mother and I got married, I threw the letter away. If I had kept it, she might wonder, but I wanted to keep it, and even thought about hiding places, maybe in the barn or the tool shed, but what if it were ever found? I knew of no way to explain why I would keep such a letter, much less why I would take the trouble to hide it. Jenny had gone to California not long after that dance. I pretty much got over wanting to see her just once more. But I wish I could have kept the letter, even though I know it by heart. A poem by Leo Dangle, his elderly father as a young man, from Home from the Field, published by Spoon River Poetry Press, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Lumosity, brain training with over 50 challenging games from scientists working with university researchers to push cognitive research forward. Learn more at lumosity.com. And by Progressive Insurance, with insurance for cars, home, boat, motorcycles, RVs, and commercial vehicles at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
And welcome back to A Juno Afternoon. I'm Laurie Scandling with our producer, Jeff Brown. With us is Satira Sukumon. She is Thai. She is currently the owner of the Suwana restaurant, which is in the valley at the Jordan Creek Mall. And she is preparing to open a sister restaurant downtown. So the new restaurant will be called Coconut Thai Cuisine, or Coconut for short. Why another restaurant? Suwana seems to be pretty busy when I'm out there.
It's been a request for many years that people want us to be downtown, closer, so they don't have to rush the lunch rush to be in the valley, pick up the food, and try to be back here. And also, we want to expand the horizon of the business. Also, we want the cruise ship, people that work on the cruise ship, they are some mostly Asian too, and they're craving for some authentic kind of home feeling kind of food, comfort food. Yeah.
Now, where downtown will the new restaurant be, and when do you expect it to be open?
It's located next to V Celador on a street level.
Seward Street?
Seward Street, yes. Mm-hmm.
And when can folks expect it to be open?
Right now, it's still under construction, but we hope that we can finish it up and open August 1st. And the hours will be 10 to 3. And in the summertime, we open Monday through Sunday. We open 7 days a week for summer.
Midday.
Yeah. But the special about this location is we're going to be open Friday and Saturday night at 10 p.m. to 2 a.m. to have people that go by Gore, they have a choice of another kind of food to eat when they go partying at night. So that would be a fun choice.
You're going to have a long day.
I have to hire more people.
So looking at your menu, I noticed, first of all, it looks delicious. But a couple of the items, you and I were chatting a little bit before, I note are a type of dish like lob that you can find in countries other than Thailand, for example, in Laos. Talk a little bit about where you come from in Thailand and what the influences are in that region on the food.
So originally, I'm from the northeastern part of Thailand, and we are close to Laos. We speak some local languages, Lao language, where I'm from. So this dish in particular is our family's favorite. So we just put it out there. It's have a lot of spices in it. It's very authentic, and it's really clean. It's have meat, have vegetable. It's just overall very, very tasty dish. Yeah.
What are some of the spice influences from that part of Thailand?
Common spices that, or ingredients that in America they know is lemongrass, of course. And kefir lime leaf is another type of lime, but it's producing aroma to it. So,
where do you find that here?
Locally, sometimes they can find it in Super Bear or AGI, but I have to order it from Seattle.
Because yeah. I love cooking and eating Southeast Asian food. Because
yeah.
my son lives over there, and finding some of the ingredients, like
yeah.
galangal, is not...
Yeah, that's galangal. It's
is
hard
not
to find.
Easy.
Yeah.
yeah. So what brought you from Northeast Thailand to Juneau, Alaska?
My mom used to work at Chan Thai Kitchen for a long time. I've been in Juneau since 2002 and kind of on and off. I just moved back recently in 2008.
What are the biggest challenges of trying to open a restaurant in Juneau?
Staff. I think that's the hard to find. A good people that reliable and hard worker and stay with you for a while so you don't have to worry about when you have to find a new person. That's the most challenges to open a new restaurant and keep it running.
Is there much of a Thai community here in Juneau? Are there other folks from Thailand who are living here?
We have very small. Last time I count, it's about 20 to 25 people in town. Yeah.
And what do you think appeals to people that they're going to drive all the way to the valley to get lunch from town? It sounds like you have quite a following out at Suwano. What are the most popular dishes that seem to be greatest in demand?
The summer is like number one sale. It's a clear rice wrapper with a lot of vegetable. I think people this day, they taking care of themselves. They try to eat healthier, cleaner, and all of our food is a real food. We make it from the scratch. All the sauce and everything, we try to make from the real food. And I think that's the reason people drive all the way, because we homemade. It's a fresh ingredients, and it's healthy.
We are talking with Satita Sukamon, and we are chatting with her about a second restaurant that she is planning to open in Juneau, downtown on Seward Street. They're aiming for August 1st, but likely will be somewhat later than that. You can look at the menu, which has got my mouth watering already, at Juneau Thai Coconut. That's all one word, JunoThaiCoconut.com. Thanks for coming in and sharing your plans with us.
Thank you.
This is Bird Note. It may be the weirdest noise in the woods, the thrumming whumps of the male ruffed grouse. Familiar as these accelerating burps still are to hunters and hikers of the North Woods, the origin of the bizarre sound was long a mystery. More than 250 years ago, the famous Philadelphia naturalist John Bartram informed his English colleagues that the grouse produced their drumming by clapping their wings against their sides. Others hypothesized that the sound arose when the wings were beat against the puffed-up breast, or when they were clapped together. Some suggested that the bird was striking on its perch with its wings, or even its feet. It took the advent of wildlife cinematography to solve the riddle. In the spring of 1929, Cornell University's Arthur A. Allen filmed a drumming ruffed grouse. Frame-by-frame analysis proved that the wings were striking nothing but air, hard and fast enough to produce popping sounds that ran together into the whirring drum. No longer a mystery, the drumming of the grouse remains one of the most evocative sounds of the North American forest. For BirdNote, I'm Mary McCann.
One of the more unusual outtakes, that's for sure. Thanks for staying with us on a Juno afternoon. It's blue ribbon day out there.
So nice.
In the studio with me now is Connor Landrum and Michael Christian. Is it Christian or Christensen, Michael?
Christensen.
Thank you. And they are Wishkanade.
Yeah.
I didn't even have it written down.
I feel like, so yeah, Wishkanade.
Wishkanade.
Yeah, we are not Wishkanade. We are part of Wishkanade. It's a bigger organization than just us.
Well, Wishkanade, which is a spoken word celebration typically,
mm-hmm.
recently had a major showcase. It's been within the last, 3 weeks, Connor?
Yeah, it was on the 25th of June, and it was our big fundraiser. We got some of our favorite talent out of our community, some really powerful, wonderful voices that we wanted to show off what they were capable of, and we did a really nice, polished show, and it was a big success.
Glad to hear it, and there will be a second opportunity now for folks who perhaps missed or would like to again
mm-hmm.
see the showcase, and that will be tomorrow night at our studio here, in other words, 360 North,
exactly.
which is at KTOO. We're at the corner of Whittier and Egan. It is at 7 p.m., and I can speak from experience, if you do not arrive early, like a half hour early, you may not get a seat in the studio. So
it's
tell
true.
Us what's going to happen tomorrow night.
So what's going to happen tomorrow night is we have a slightly truncated version of our showcase. So there'll still be music. There'll be a little bit less of a show just because we've got time constraints. It's only a 57-minute recording session, so we couldn't do the full length. But we are also, it's a pay-as-you-can show, so if you weren't able to come up with the $25 a couple of weeks ago, come, do pay-as-you-can, and get a good exposure to the real heart and soul of the show that is still going to be there, even though it's a slightly shorter event.
Michael, you were in the showcase, and you have participated in quite a number of the spoken word events. Talk a little bit about your role and what has drawn you to spoken word. I've read your work before in the paper, and I know that you're an author. So how does that – talk about that translation from what you write to how you say it.
That's,
he starts with um.
He starts with um.
That's a very good question.
Yeah.
I think that there is the connection with the audience that you don't get when you write something and put it in a drawer. And it's the whoosh. Kanade has a very sense of an inclusive community.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it really helps make me feel part of a community of writers that are bigger than myself. And I know that this person is writing this, so I don't have to, so I can write this, so we can cover everything. I think
there's that. It makes it a bit more of a conversation. When you've got Wushkanade and you're a community, you can be thought of as one giant conversation that's going on about the issues and topics that are important to that community. And Wushkanade is, first, it's a community of writers and artists and people who want to be a part of that. Like, even the people who aren't on the board or don't volunteer, the people who come month after month and either participate or just audience members, like, even just being an audience member is participating by showing up and being a part of it. And so, as also, prose writer who has more stuff that's, you can think of it, that's not oral, that you just write it down and you, show it to people or whatever, when you are performing in front of a bunch of other people and other people are there at the same event for the same reasons, then you feel like you're part of this living communal thing that you don't necessarily get that feeling when it's a published thing. And like, you know, other people are reading it, but you're not there and you're not looking those people in the eyes and you're not hearing what they have to say. And you're also not being measured up against people who you consider your peers and are proud to be peers with them.
So there's a synergy with that spoken word. You mentioned the word community, and many communities that gather around and coalesce have a tilt or a point of view. Mm-hmm. Would you say Wush Kanade has such? And if so, what is it?
Yeah, I absolutely would. I would say that our point of view is that we are concerned about making sure we're an inclusive community. We do events at different locations every month. We always make sure that they're all ages and they're either free or very, very cheap, because we want it to be a safe space where literally anybody can come and perform or watch or talk and feel that they are included, because we are about inclusiveness and expression and creating a safe space for people to come and be a part of that. So that's our point of view. Our point of view is that it's important to have an artistic space for people to come and express themselves, to hear other people expressing themselves, and to hold space and appreciation and respect for each other.
Michael, what's your role in the taping tomorrow night? Will you be performing?
I will be performing a long piece that I originally wrote for the showcase that I thought when I began writing it was about a road trip with H.P. Lovecraft and William Faulkner going to the mythical South.
Mm-hmm.
That was what I thought. That was my taking off point.
And where did you land?
I have no idea. And that's why you can go to a poetry reading more than once or, you know, three times, and it's like, it might mean something different this time. I'm not sure.
Yeah. It's kind of like a meal. Like, sure, you might use the same recipe, but it's going to taste different every time.
Yeah.
Michael, how did you find that? How did that inspiration come to you, this Southern trip with the authors?
I think that a lot of times people tell you, write what you've known. I think that's bad advice, because how will you ever learn anything? So I thought, what is something that I don't know anything about? And I came up with the American South in 1923.
Sure.
And I thought, yeah,
very specific.
Let's do that. Let's do that. I don't know anything about
that. Let's do that with some flying squid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, you said, Michael, you labeled it a long piece. In the spoken word world, say that five times fast, what qualifies as long?
In a slam, a poem has to be 3 minutes or less. Ooh. So after you write for slams a lot, you just automatically, a poem is 3 minutes long.
Mm-hmm.
And you have that constraint, which gives you an idea of what you can do in that amount of time. So doing a longer piece that's, you know, maybe 15 minutes long, really took me a couple of runs at it to get, but I broke it down into like 3 5-minute pieces.
Mm-hmm. So, interesting. Connor, you've shared before that you're a prose writer and mm-hmm. more of a writer than a speaker. Will you have a role tomorrow night?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I would not say I'm not a speaker. I just don't do spoken word.
Well,
I talk a lot.
You're a major cheerleader.
I just like at the previous showcase, I will be emceeing the event. Unfortunately, my co-host will not be able to join me from that event, but I promise I'll be able to, limp along without him somehow. But, so I'll be officiating. I'll be doing the introducing. I'll introduce the different artists. I'll make up some stuff on the spot, because that's what MCs do. I'll be thanking people. I'll be talking about our community. I'll be the guy that people wait to stop talking so the next artist can come on.
You're the verbal glue.
Yeah.
We're talking with Connor Lindrum and Michael Christensen about a live taping tomorrow night here at KTOO Studios downstairs. at 7 p.m. It will be a condensed version of the Wishkanadei spoken word showcase that occurred about 3 weeks ago. It is free, although donations are very much welcome, and we encourage you to arrive at about 6:30.
Yeah, the taping starts at 7, so that's when they...
That's not Juno 7, that's real 7.
That's real 7, and so like it starts at 7. If you're not there before that, the doors are going to be closed, and you won't be able to get in.
Fair warning. Thank you, gentlemen. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having us.
With a Juno afternoon in the studio with me is Renee Hughes. I know her best as the caretaker of the Last Chance Mining Museum, but she and her husband, Gary Gillette, have another role, and that is the caretakers as well as the, it's even more than caretaker. You folks have done so much work at the Sentinel Lighthouse, and we're here to talk about that today. Renee, how long have you and Gary had involvement with the Sentinel Lighthouse, which is off Eagle Beach? You can see it with the naked eye from Eagle Beach.
You can see it from Eagle Beach. You can actually see the tower from the Shrine of St. Therese. And it'll be 20 years next year that we have had ownership of the Sentinel Island. And Gary and I refer to ourselves as the keepers.
There's the right word.
And so we've been very busy out there for the last 20 years. We acquired the lighthouse from the department. The Secretary of Interior came in, and she did the transfer, Gail Norton, and that was a real big day. And since then, when it was just basically a bare concrete tower that still had some old musty smells in it and things, that we've gone in and we've painted the tower. We've done a lot of restoration work on the inside. And this year, we received a grant so that we can replace the glass in the lantern room. So that's our big project this summer.
It's a wonderful facility, and I speak from experience. It's only a one-hour kayak ride from Eagle Beach, and there is a very specific landing area that you help people identify. How many folks can sleep out there at one time? You've built a number of bed bases and bunks as well.
The bunks in the tower can accommodate 6. But we've had as many as 20 people out there. When Saga, the group that used to be in town and did a lot of community projects, they agreed to help paint the tower. So they sent a bunch of young people out there with a group of adults, and it was a long process, but they managed to get the whole tower painted. So that was pretty exciting. It needs it again, as all things in Southeast
Alaska.
Especially when you're out there in the water. And so that'll be coming up, but right now the main focus is on the lantern room.
Now, do you own that island and the lighthouse, or is it an agreement with the federal government? And talk a little bit about what is part of the ownership responsibility.
The Coast Guard did transfer over ownership. When we first acquired the lighthouses, it was for a 30-year lease, but several of us were running into problems with getting funding and writing grants and even getting loans because no one wanted to offer us a loan because the Coast Guard could make our lease go away. So that's the reason for the transfer. And so now the Historic Society owns the lighthouse and basically the whole island. The Coast Guard comes out and maintains the light, so it is still an active aid to navigation. So if you're out there and you lost your way, sometimes in the fog, that little light is a big help.
Big lifesaver. And what's the responsibility that owners have, having received this former, well, and still, I suppose, in some way, a public piece of property if it's still serving mariners?
Well, we own it, but it is available to the public, but you have to do it by appointment through us. We do rent the tower out, so if someone like yourself wants to go out there and have a wonderful weekend, then we make you the keeper for however long you wish to stay out there. And it's been pretty exciting. We've had weddings out there and birthday parties, and this summer the university's got a group that's going out every other week to do whale research.
It is a wonderful setting, and typically you do have some fresh water available, although people should know to bring their own fresh water. And there is an outhouse there, I should say, with a fantastic view.
The Lighthouse Outhouse.
I found it interesting that you can hear the rookery of sea lions, which are at least a mile away, but you can hear those sea lions making
You can hear
them,
and you can also see them if you hike out to the north end of the island.
So what are the biggest challenges of owning a property like that? It's pretty old. When was the lighthouse built?
The original tower was built in 1902. Five Fingers and Sentinel were lit on the same day, so they were the first ones to start the aid to navigation program in Alaska. It was an original Victorian house. It was a duplex, so the keeper and the assistant keeper lived out there. And one of the things I find fascinating is that they stayed out there in the wintertime, and if you had more than five children, you qualified as your own school district. So Sentinel Island had its own school district with its own teacher, and in the wintertime, the children and families, in order to share time together, had to go through the crawl space in the attic to get to the other side instead of venturing outside where the weather can be a little treacherous.
What do you find after 20 years is the biggest challenge of working the site? A lot of work has happened there.
It's amazing what we've managed to accomplish. They've gotten the interiors now drywalled. This weekend they're finishing up the trim on the inside, so all the windows. The hardest part was when the Coast Guard unmanned it, they infilled all the walls with concrete, so the windows were there no longer, and they used rebar. So we would transport out this very large drill, and we would punch holes in the concrete so that we could replace the windows. That was a big challenge. I must say, the best day, it could have been the worst day, but we were out there. We brought this piece of equipment, built the scaffolding, we're ready to go, and it doesn't work. Well, Gary called Tyler and said, "What do you want me to do?" And the guy said, "I don't know. What do you want us to do?" And he said, "I've got a crew and no equipment." Well, Tyler actually chartered a helicopter.
Tyler Rental, you're talking
Tyler
about.
Tyler Rental.
Wow.
And they chartered a helicopter to bring us another piece of equipment so that we could finish the job.
I should say the light in the lighthouse is wonderful, so thank you for punching those holes through. It makes it a very, very delightful place to be.
We've done 13 windows out there.
That's a lot of work. Now, how can folks learn more about the availability of the lighthouse, what some of the amenities are, how to get there? Does the lighthouse have a website of its own?
The Historic Society is working on a website that is up there. Facebook is a good place to look for us. The best thing to do is to call me directly.
Okay, and why don't you give that number?
It's 586-5338, and I can tell you, the first question I ask is, how do you want to get out there? The easiest way is the most economical way to get out there is by kayak. If you own a boat and you can trust somebody to drop you off, that's an efficient way. If you're going for something special and you can afford it, Coastal Helicopters is very well experienced with landing out there, and we've got platforms with steps and things to get down. The platform where the coastal lands is actually on the foundation of the original house.
I wondered where that, you can see the outline of some building there. And what is the cost for folks to stay out there? It's a per-person cost, right?
It's $75 a person, and that covers our expenses for getting the fuel and the water and helping us with the preservation work out there. We do ask everyone to become a member of the Historic Society to show their support for what we're doing out there. And that's just a wonderful way to help us continue what we're doing out there.
And is there a calendar online, or should folks just call you about that?
You have
that?
To call me.
Okay. We're talking with Renee Hughes about Sentinel Lighthouse. It's about, maybe 3 miles offshore, because I kayak at the speed of about 3 miles an hour offshore from Eagle Beach, and easily reached by boat, even more easily reached by helicopter, and up to, places for six folks to sleep, but certainly more. There's lots of floor space. There is a heating unit there, and some fresh water is available. That's at Sentinel Lighthouse. And if you'd like more information, please call Renee at 586-5338. Do you have some vacancies this summer?
I have a few left, but, you know, even without advertising, it's still becoming a more popular place to go the more we've done out there.
It's such a unique place. And as I recall, you do provide a refund if the weather prohibits safe transit out there.
We want everyone to be safe. That is the bottom line. If I thought it was unsafe, I would tell you.
Great. Thanks for joining us, Renee.
You're welcome. Thanks, Lori.
Shaving your face, taking out the trash, and knowing your place, spending all your cash on your baby, and do it daily, like walking the dog, cleaning up the mess, before you go off to work, and make a good guess, have what your woman wants, and do it daily, if you're gonna do it at all, you gotta do it daily, do it every day, in the very best way, if you're gonna do it at all, and do it daily. Do it once, do it twice. Take little advice and do it every day.
Every day.
Like that little mistake that you always make. Look it straight in the eyes and apologize. And never do it again. And do it daily. And when you do it again, say you're sorry and then try to do it right. Screw it up every night and apologize again. And do it daily. If you're gonna do it at all, you gotta do it daily.
Do it daily.
Do it every day. In the very best way.
In the very best way.
If you do it at all, do it once or twice, take little advice and do it every day. Muffins and sages and good friends and wise men say, oh, good things happen.
We're listening to Martin Sexton right now. Thanks for this music, Jeff. Martin Sexton will be one of the many, many performers at this year's Southeast Alaska Fair, as always, held in Haines, and as always, a very fun time. We're speaking with Jessica Edwards. Welcome, Jessica. You're in Haines.
Hi. I am. Hi, Lori.
Great. Thanks for speaking with us today. Are you the executive director of the fair, and have you had that position for quite some time?
Well, I am the executive director. I've been the executive director since 2013, and I've worked here at the fair since 2010.
I was going to say, I thought I'd seen your name associated with it. So what makes the Southeast Alaska State Fair special?
You know, it's a good question. I think the Southeast Alaska State Fair it's quirky. It's smaller than a lot of fairs that people may have gone to in other places, including Palmer or in Washington State. And I think our fair really reflects Southeast communities. It's a different flavor. It feels, it's busy and it's got lots of activity happening, but we have things like the Fisherman's Rodeo, we have a logging show, we have arts and crafts exhibits in the hall that really show, if you look around the photography section, for instance, you see scenes of our lives here in Southeast Alaska and the kind of vegetables that we grow and whatnot. So I think it really is kind of a cool reflection of how we do life and art here in Southeast Alaska.
I have to say I've seen some mean competition in horseshoes as well.
That's right. We have quite a fierce group locally that compete, and I know that it's always a great time to get folks from other communities to come in and pit their skills against the local group.
Now, a couple of the last times I've been there, there has been a smaller version of the wearable arts show that appears here in Juneau. Will that be a feature as well this year?
Yes, Friday night. It's very popular, and we call it a review. So we call it the wearable art review because many shows that you go to in the different communities, Juneau, Sitka, Ketchikan, people are bringing their original designs, and those designs are not shown anywhere else before that runway show. Well, we invite all the communities to send designs from their shows so that people at the fair can see representative pieces from the Ketchikan show this year and the Sitka show and the Juno show. And then we also do have original works that are put in every year. So it's really fun, and it's always very popular and well-attended on Friday night.
Now, in looking through the music lineup, and music has for years really been a highlight of the State Fair, there seemed to be a distinct Rasta flavor this year. Are you the person who organized that?
You know, I'm not. We have an entertainment coordinator, and his name's Scott Ramsey. He's quite an aficionado of shows. He goes to a lot of shows himself. This is his second year. And last year we had more of a, I guess I would call it a jam band flavor. There was just more of a funk flavor. And this year we definitely have quite a few reggae acts all across the spectrum of that art form. We had a couple groups last year, and they were just so well received and very popular. I think when Scott went to book music this year, he kind of got into that vein a little bit. And I'm a pretty big reggae fan, but I'm really excited to see some of these bands really push the limits for me of what reggae is. And so, yeah, there's a lot of big acts with lots of different kind of instrumentation, and I think it's going to be really, really fun.
Talk about some of the acts who have been booked.
Okay, so I guess if I want to start with reggae, I will start with John Brown's Body. They're a big group out of Colorado. They've been touring. They're really popular in the Mountain States in the Midwest, and they're coming with 9 people. They've got a big sound. They've got keyboards and brass and the whole thing, so they'll be really fun to listen to. They're playing Saturday night. They're kind of our anchor headliner on Saturday night. We also have, in the reggae vein, we have Wet City Rockers. They came last year, did one show for us, and they're from Seattle. So they have kind of that Pacific Northwest vibe to them, and they're really fun. They're coming back. They'll be here Friday night. And then also the third kind of reggae-ish act we have is really a genre-bending one, but it's Satsang, and they're from Montana. And a local person who's come to the fair for 20 years had seen them play in Montana and just said they are so wonderful. Their energy is great. They have such a great on stage presence, and so they got booked as well. And they're fun. Satsang will play a couple different sets Friday afternoon and also Saturday night. I guess out of the reggae genre, there's lots of other music. I don't want to give people the impression that this is going to be a reggae festival in any way, because we have lots of other music, including, we're really excited about Martin Sexton is coming to headline Friday night this year. And he's, of course, an amazing vocalist and guitar player, and is just, we've been having tons of buzz about this. People are super excited to come and see his show.
Well, we just previewed his music a little bit. So let me ask you, does the Haines State Fair break even?
You know, we do. So our goal, our mission, we're a nonprofit organization, and our goal is to put on a fair every year. That's part of our mission statement. But we also have in our mission statement that we have to be self-perpetuating. We have to be sustainable. So we always try to budget enough that we are able to pay our salaries, and we have a 42-acre property here that we have to maintain year-round for lots of events. So we do, the fair brings in enough money between that and the other big event that we do in the year, Beer Fest. We're able to certainly maintain a budget that allows for sustainable growth and property maintenance on a pretty big scale, and having staff to make sure that the events go well. So, yeah, it's a good question.
What are the dates this year of the Southeast Alaska State Fair?
Okay, so our fair begins on Thursday, July 28th. And it runs through the 31st. It's 4 days. And for people who are thinking about coming from Juneau or other communities, we have a fantastic ferry schedule this year. I'm super excited about it. We have Fairweather Express runs Wednesday and Thursday and Friday, and you can come just for Saturday if you want. And then the return trips are also very, very accommodating. There's lots of trips back and forth between Juneau and Haines on the Alaska Marine Highway all weekend. So we're really thrilled about that schedule. And we also have at least one of the airlines is offering a nice fare, $100 one-way fares for the fair.
Terrific. Great. Thanks for joining us, Jessica. And a website? Leave us with your website.
Visit us at www.seakfair.org.
All right. Thanks for your work, Jessica. Have fun.
Hey, Lori. Thank you so much. Bye.
This is KTOO Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and